giving some axioms for quantum theory. So you had already, I think, a set of axioms in the course that that Joe Emerson taught. And this is a slightly different set of axioms. And this is these are axioms for pure state quantum theory. It's useful to have a set of axioms just to refer back to when you're looking at this foundational questions. So axiom one, says associated with each system, A is a Hilbert space. I'll write this down. I'll explain what the notation I'm using here in a moment. So associated with each system, A1 is a Hilbert space. Labeled by that of some dimension. So A is the type of system, so whether you have, for example, an electron or a photon, that's labeled by A or B or C. And then the one is the particular instance of the system. You may have two electrons, and then you'll have one and two. So the dimension of the Hilbert space depends only on the type of system, of course. Second axiom is if you have a type, if you have a composite system, then the Hilbert space is given by the tensor products of the Hilbert spaces for the each of the components. So for example, you might denote a composite system by A1, A2, B3, C4. So you have two systems of the same type here, and then two other types of system. So in this particular example, the Hilbert space will be given by this tensor product. Maybe, for example, you have a box that produces a pair of a particular type of system, like an electron. So this is here. So you have two electrons being produced. So we can call this one one and this one two, just so we know which one we're referring to. So they're both, in this case, electrons, but we're referring to the integer is just a label which type, which particular instance of. We have. So we have two electrons, is one, is the other.
Interpreting the system as an electron itself, or I mean, in the quantum theory taught by Emerson, like he tried to emphasize the quantum state as a
Right, okay. Yeah, so really what this, these different instances are labeling is operationally operationally accessible instances. So you can access, you can imagine this is a box, it has a hole in it here, another hole in it here. Out of this hole, you imagine an electron comes, and out of this one also. So these are both operationally addressable separately. And so really, you can think of it in those same terms that Joe was teaching. Yeah, is that clear? Okay. The third axiom is that the state, and here we're just talking about only, we're talking about pure states. The system is given by an element of the associated Hilbert space. And of course, this Hilbert space could be a composite Hilbert space. So in which case, you have the possibility of entangled states. The fourth axiom concerns evolution. And it has two parts. So the first part is when you're making no measurements. So the state evolves under a unitary operator. Doesn't really matter where I put this, I'll do it that way instead. Okay. And B, this is so the second part of this evolution axiom is when there is a measurement. And in this case, the state is projected down to, it's projected with the projector that's associated with the measurement outcome. So this is especially problematic. I'm going to spend some time talking about the issues that come up. So there's one more axiom to do with how to calculate probabilities. I'll write that down. Well, I write it down now. So you calculate the probability by looking at the amplitude in front of the term you project down to, and you take the modulus squared. Or you can just write it like this. You can say that the probability is given by same as so this is the state after you project, and the amplitude. The modulus of the amplitude squared is the same as this, which is just that. Usually what we do is you look at, yeah, go on, please.
If we do this, don't we have to renormalize in 4D?
Right, so there's, what people usually do is when every time they see a quantum state, they normalize it. So you can do that here. You could change this axiom. You could say, well, you project down this to this, and then you divide by the appropriate constant to get the states renormalized. And that's what people would normally do. It's really a matter of what you're trying to calculate. And it's actually quite useful. I would say better to work with the unnormalized state. And the reason for that is, imagine you have a sequence of measurements. Okay, here, here, here. If you don't normalize, what you'll have at the end is a state, you know, whose amplitude decreases after each measurement. And if you take the square modulus of that amplitude, it'll give you the joint probability of each of these things happening. Whereas if you do take the, if you renormalize after each measurement, what you'll be calculating is if you renormalize here, then you're calculating the conditional probability of this stuff happening after this measurement and so on. And that's a bit more complicated mathematically because you have to keep dividing. And if you've got the joint probabilities, then you can always calculate conditional probabilities afterwards if you want. It's just as easy to calculate any joint probabilities you want afterwards by looking at, sorry, any, it's just as easy to calculate any conditional probabilities you want afterwards by looking at the joint probabilities.
So the probability max implied is also
Yes, I would say, yeah. So if you have a whole sequence of measurements, the probability you're getting out is the joint probability. But most places in the literature, people do renormalize the state afterwards. I think it's the wrong thing to do because you're throwing away information, whereas if you don't normalize the state, you're keeping that information, which can be useful, has some useful information in it. Okay. So I said there's a problem here. There's a problem that's usually called the measurement problem, but I prefer a different name, which is the reality problem. Okay, let's see what I can do here. This name was given by Philip Pearl. Also known as the reality, also known as the measurement problem. Okay. So that's actually what's one way to look at this is to look at the example we had yesterday, where we have a source and a beam splitter and then two detectors. So what happened there was that the state starts off like this. It evolves. Past the beam splitter, and then it evolves into the detectors. So we have one term corresponding to detector A firing, and another term corresponding to detector B firing. Okay. Now then, according to part B, a measurement has occurred, and so we should project down to the term associated with the measurement outcome. So imagine we see detector A fires. Then we'd have that. Now, the problem is really a dilemma. So one attitude you might take here is that this is very unnatural to just project down, because you know it's a very different kind of evolution. Really, we should just stick with this. So we should say that the state afterwards is this. And then we should try and make sense of it. The only problem is that there's a discrepancy between the most obvious interpretation of this state, which is that it describes the way the world is, having this superposition, and what we actually see. So what we actually see when we look is one thing or the other. So this is a dilemma. And we could try to, you know, we could try to make this go away by inserting ourselves into the picture. So let's put myself. I'm going to put me here. In the sort of zero state, so I haven't seen anything yet. And then over here, I can evolve it so that we have me. Seeing the A click, Maybe I should write that in proper, more grammatically. I see. And then we can have over here, I see. The B click. And so we still have the same problem. Now it's just, I'm involved in this superposition. And now I know that if I was to do this experiment and look at the detectors, I would only see one of these two terms. I would either see A or B. So that's one horn of the dilemma. If we don't project, then there's this discrepancy between what we see and what the state seems to be telling us. Or if we do project, well then there's no longer a discrepancy, but we have a problem which is what is it that makes measurement special compared with other systems? Why do we only project when it's something that we call a measurement? What's the sort of physical system that constitutes a measurement? Does it have to have a certain number of atoms? Does it have to be conscious? Will a dog do? So John Bell, who talked about this a lot, asked if you have to have a PhD to be able to collapse. So you guys will have to work on that. Getting through chalk today. So if you look in the literature, there are different attempts to answer these questions in interpretations, and we'll discuss interpretations in a lot more detail, and I guess next week. You could attempt to take this horn of the dilemma, so you say, well, we do not project, because that seems unnatural, and then you have this superposition of two terms. And there are basically two ways of resolving that. One is to say that this state vector isn't a complete description of the world, that there's some extra information that we should include as part of the full description that singles out one of these two terms. And that's the approach taken by the de Broglie-Bohm model, the pilot wave model. Or hidden variable interpretations in general would take that kind of approach, probably. If we take this horn, is the so-called many worlds interpretation. So this is where we say, well, no, this is actually the state of the world. The state of the universe is given by the superposition. It's a full description. There's nothing extra. Now we just have to make sense of it. And we have to think carefully about how, even though the world is actually described by the superposition, from our vantage point, it seems or feels like we only see one or the other of these two branches, and you get into the whole, the whole many worlds point of view, which we'll talk about in detail. Or if you do project, then if you want to say, well, you actually project, then you need to do proper physics. You need to say what it is that constitutes a measurement apparatus. Or more generally, you need to give a proper physical theory that treats all physical systems equally and yet causes the sorts of systems we would typically regard as being measurement apparatuses to project down, to collapse, while those which are normally behave quantumly would not project down. And so there are some explicit collapse models in the literature. And what they do typically is they modify the Schrodinger equation and include some extra terms that force the wave function to collapse for sufficiently big systems. Okay. Are there any questions at this point? It's a big area. Nope. Okay. So just thinking about this a bit more. If we take this approach and we don't project, then the sort of two, there's two questions. Well, actually, this applies to both approaches. There's two questions we have to answer. Over here. Yeah, so if you're trying to solve this, the measurement problem or the reality problem, there's kind of two things you need to answer. So first of all, what is a natural basis with respect to which definite outcomes are associated? If you look at this example here, so the final observation is, you know, ICA or ICB, but why isn't it the case that instead the two things I'm aware of are you could imagine that the experience I have in my brain is actually corresponds to one or the other of these two states. They're orthogonal states. Maybe for some people it is. I don't know. So the question is, why? What is the natural basis with respect to which we want to associate these definite outcomes? And in the literature, an answer to this question is provided by decoherence. So in decoherence, what you do is you have the system you're interested in, then the environment, and the two things interact. And then if you just restrict yourself to the system that you're interested in, because the environment and the system are getting entangled, if you just look at the system itself, it will tend to go into a mixed state. And after enough time, that mixed state will be fairly well, it'll be fairly diagonal, and it'll be diagonal in a particular basis. And that's a natural basis, and it's the mathematically natural basis with respect to which you might want to associate definite outcomes. Yep.
But you say it becomes fairly diagonal, not completely.
Right, yep.
Wouldn't that mean that I see mostly A, but still a little bit?
Absolutely, yeah, these are problems, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, let me finish one particular point here. So, one thing that's interesting is if you look at the sorts of the typical Hamiltonians we have in nature are local, so they couple things that are at the same position. They don't couple systems that are very different positions. So, typically, the kinds of states that you get decoherence to are states which are local. So. So these things correspond to different, sort of states which are different in terms of their positions. So if a pointer might be here or here, this is locally different. So this gives you a kind of answer to that question, but you're right, it's not an exact answer, and that's a problem. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so the different answers to that, one is to say, well, there are separate reasons for your Hamiltonians being local, you know, to do with special relativity, you want to make your theory the Lorentz invariant or something like this. So those are the kinds of Hamiltonians that appear naturally. There's a different approach, and maybe a more interesting approach, would be to say that actually the notion of locality is derived from the natural basis that you see decoherence in. And if you were to take that approach, then you could imagine trying to derive locality, some sort of property of locality, by looking at the properties of you know, Hamiltonians that were not chosen with regard to locality properties, but chosen by some other means. And there's been some work in that direction. I think it's an interesting problem. Okay. Now, okay. So this is in some sense. So this is one problem you have. What's the natural basis? But it's the easier problem to solve. On your question about this being imprecise. When I talk about the Manuel's interpretation, then they have an argument that this kind of imprecision doesn't matter. So you may be able to overcome that. There's a certain approach to the Manuel's interpretation where it's argued you don't have to have a precise answer to this kind of question. But we'll come to that next week. Okay, so the second question is... So what is it that actually picks out a particular outcome in a particular run of an experiment? Or at the very least, what is it that gives rise to the observation that a particular outcome is picked out? Sensation, I guess. Just because you found a mathematically natural basis, if you have found a mathematically natural basis, doesn't mean that you provided the extra definition that says, you know, the what it is that physically picks out a particular outcome. Okay. How much time I have here. Okay. There is a another attitude you can take. If you're only interested in using this set of axioms to do calculations, then you can say that for all practical purposes, FAP, this works. So long as you project, when you do this projection in axiom 4b, you do it at a sufficiently macroscopic level. So this FAP was invented by John Bell And he invented it as a sort of rhetorical device to show what was wrong with quantum theory. So it is true that for all practical purposes, if you have some, if you have, you know, an experiment like the one I drew, then you have me, look roughly like this. If you project at the level of the detectors, and you take the square modulus and you get the probabilities, you'll get the same answer when you project at the level of the neurons in my brain, or indeed anywhere between the detectors and here. And as long as you don't project at too early a stage where there's still some possibility of interfering the two alternatives, then for all practical purposes, you'll always get the right answers. Now, the reason it's for all practical purposes is because, in principle, even if these detection events are macroscopic, it's still possible that you could reverse them and recover the interference. Okay, at least in principle, there's nothing that rules out this in principle. So you could somehow undo the detection events and bring the two possibilities back together and see interference. So although that's very difficult, in principle it's possible. Or even if you chose, you could, even afterwards, you could reverse engineer it. Even after I've seen the event, you know, someone else over here could imagine reversing the system, doing something terrible to the neurons inside my brain and recovering the interference. So it's possible in principle, but in practice it's very difficult. But it is curious that as long as you choose the projection at a sufficiently macroscopic level, and as long as you don't allow, you know, these very very difficult processes of reversing the measurement process, then you get the same answer regardless of where you put the collapse.
Are you saying that reversing the collapse process here and the deleting the collapse model?
Reversing the reversing this process. So before you collapse, you get to this state here. This is some unitary evolution. If you haven't collapsed at this stage, it's still possible in principle to reverse this and recover interference between the two outcomes, between the two possibilities.
And if I only see the last step, like A has a product with B zero.
Oh yeah, then we have a problem. So this is the point that imagine we apply projection or collapse. If we apply after the detection events, okay, before the before I look at the apparatus, okay. Well, in that case, we'll be reversing this part of the state, and we'd be able to detect that there was a collapse. In principle, very difficult in practice because it's difficult to implement this. But in principle, we could detect that there was a collapse at this stage. What I'm trying to say is, it's physically different in principle. What time you choose to implement the collapse. In practice, it's very difficult to distinguish these different possibilities, but in principle, it makes a difference at what time you collapse, because that would affect subsequent experimental data. Okay. Well, maybe we can talk about it more later. Okay. Right. Are there any more questions on measurement problem or these axioms? So I want to move on to looking at a few interesting quantum phenomena. The first one is the no-cloning theorem, and the second one, if we get time, is the quantum Zeno effect. Okay, so here's the question. So imagine we have a machine, M. That's capable of cloning states. So this would mean that we have some state, the system we want to clone. Then we have the machine. And now we evolve, and that machine clones. So we now have two copies of the state we wish to clone. Sorry? Oh, so M is the initial state of the machine. Psi is some state of the system you're trying to clone. Oh, it hasn't really, well, this is a different type of system. So you can imagine that inside M, there's a system of type A that's spat out, and then the system type for M changes. We want this to be true for all states in the Hilbert space associated with that system. So the no cloning theorem says that this isn't possible. And I'll give you the proof in a moment. It's interesting. So this theorem was, I don't know the exact date, but it was in the mid 80s, I think. Do you know the date of the no cloning theorem? Mid 80s. But what happened is some people published or submitted a paper to a journal claiming to show that you could signal faster than light using entanglement. And then this paper was distributed around. And it turned out that the mistake was that they were implicitly assuming that you could clone. So when people saw that, then they came up with the no cloning theorem. So a bunch of different people independently came up with it. The reference that's normally given is Wouters and Zurich. They wrote a paper showing that you couldn't clone. But they were motivated by this this earlier paper claiming to show that you could signal faster than light. Okay, does anyone know how to prove this? Any ideas? Okay, well, there's two strategies. I think one is in the homework tutorial. Okay, so I'll give you the other approach. So what you can do is you can, well, this has to be true for arbitrary psi. So let's write down the same expression. For a different state. And now we want to see what happens. If you look at these two expressions, well, because you have the same unitary transformation in both cases, it has to be the case that the inner product of the two expressions on the left-hand side are the same as the inner product on the right-hand side. That's the nature of unitary transformations. So we need, so let's take the inner product of these expressions. We need that that's true. Now, if you look at this, if you want to make this true, then either these two states have to be orthogonal, or, well, we think they can cancel down. Oh, and this thing here is equal to 1 anyway. So then on this side, we cancel this factor. We get 1 equals equals that. And we can take the the modulus of this expression. And so we can see that because these two numbers have to multiply to give 1, and we know that these states, if these states are normalized initially, then so each of these two factors here have to be less than or equal to 1. So the only way that this can be satisfied is if that's true. So it means that we can clone pairs of states, but we can only clone pairs of states if those two states are either the same state or orthogonal. But we can't clone arbitrary pairs of states. Arbitrary states. So that's the proof of the no cloning theorem. It's kind of, I mean, it wasn't until sometime in the 80s that the theorem was proved. It's kind of an important theorem. I think it gave rise to a new way of thinking about quantum theory that you know, ultimately led to the whole quantum information approach. So you did teleportation with Joe Emerson, is that right? Quantum teleportation. So the only reason teleportation is interesting is because you can't clone quantum states. So you can't just make another copy of a quantum state. If that were the case, then quantum teleportation would really just be like a fax machine. You put a copy in, you get another copy somewhere else. It's only interesting because although you can't clone quantum states, you can reproduce a quantum state somewhere else. So this way of thinking about the information inside a state, and it's sort of it's very much there in the background in teleportation as well, in quantum teleportation, so it led to a certain way of thinking about quantum theory that ultimately led to quantum information. Okay. So I think I have long enough to talk about the quantum Zeno effect as well. So 19, so this, I do have the date, 1977. It was Sudarshan and Misra. So this is a curious effect in quantum theory. It's very generic. It happens in any quantum system where you have a Schrodinger or unitary evolution. So you have a system. You start it in some state. So it can be any state. We'll call that state zero. And now we evolve the system just through some very small delta t. And the new state afterwards is given by acting with this operator on the original state. And you can expand out the first few terms. So you get this term which dominates. Then you get this term which is just depends on delta t. And then you get higher order terms, which are very small if you're only interested in small delta t. So the basis behind the quantum Zeno effect is that if you look at this, you can see that if you make a measurement after time delta t to see what the state of the system is, in particular to see if the system is still in the original state, so you perform a projection onto the original state, then the probability of it not being in that state is given by the square modulus of this term here. Or rather, yeah, given by the square of this, and so that it goes as delta t squared. So let me just explain that in a bit more detail. So we perform a projection onto this state at time delta t. So we have the state. So if you imagine that the system has a set of states from 0 up to n, this is a basis, then we can write down the orthogonal projector like so. And we can use this to do a calculation. The probability that we see after this projection, that we project on this like so, so that's just if we do this calculation, then we get one minus, oh, so we get here, we get some constant squared times delta t squared. And so that means in particular that the probability of staying in the same state, getting this answer, is one minus delta t squared times k squared. K is just some constant that depends on the Hamiltonian. You can work that out easily enough. Okay. Sorry? Because here, if I substitute this in to this expression, then I have a delta t coming on the left-hand side and on the right-hand side, so I get delta t squared. The other terms cancel, or a zero, if you do the calculation, and so you get delta t squared. I don't want to. What you can show, I won't go into. I'll just finish off tomorrow. The real quantum Zeno effect is that if you keep making measurements every delta t, you can stop the system evolving. And it's different from classical physics. So in classical physics, if you had a similar situation, you wouldn't have a delta t squared; you'd have a delta t. So decay. So think, for example, of radioactive decay. If you just do the standard calculation you do for classical radioactive decay, if there is such a thing. Then the probability decay, the probability goes as delta t rather than delta t squared. So this is something special to quantum theory, that by looking at the system repeatedly, you disturb it and you can stop it from evolving. So I'll rather than trying to squeeze in the whole proof, I'll finish that off tomorrow.